coming up on 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. First, we'll be hearing from best-selling author Tom Clavin talking about his latest book, an amazing survival story from World War II called Lightning Down. In part two, you'll be hearing from Rita Hagen from the Kenosha Hospice Alliance and from an author which they have brought to town, Sherry Bartsch, talking about her book called Heaven's Bell. Stay with us. Here is part one of today's morning show. It's always a distinct pleasure when I can reconnect with an author with whom I have already spoken on a couple of different occasions about previous books. And such is the case today with best-selling author Tom Clavin. We have spoken previously about his book Dodge City and also Tombstone, and also Last Men Out, which he co-wrote with Bob Drury, the dramatic story of the dramatic exit of American troops out of Vietnam in the waning days of that conflict. His latest book is called Lightning Down, a World War II story of survival, which involves a number of Allied pilots, Joe Mosier among them, who are downed and imprisoned by the Germans, not in a standard POW camp, but actually in the notorious camp known as Buchenwald. And the story of their endurance, of their ability to survive such terrible treatment, and much of the historical context of this story is told in remarkable fashion in this book published by St. Martin's Press, again titled Lightning Down, a World War II story of survival. And Tom Clavin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being back on the show.
Glad to be reconnecting. So it never ceases to amaze me how even with something like the Second World War, which has been studied and written about so extensively, there still are untold stories or largely forgotten stories. Tell us how you came across this particular story that, at least to the wider public, is all but completely unknown.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, because one would think that we're more than 70 years after the end of World War II, that there's nothing left to be mined here, that there are no more stories that to be told. And yet, back in December 2015, I was actually researching something else, and I happened to come across in a local State of Washington weekly newspaper an obituary for a fellow named Joe Mosier. And it mentioned that he had been a pilot in World War II, and he had been one of 170 pilots who were secretly and illegally put into Buchenwald, the one of the more notorious Nazi concentration camps. And so I said, I have to, what? You know, this exclamation point moment, what do you mean? I mean, as far as any of us knew, certainly as books portrayed, movies, things like that, if you were a downed American pilot and were captured, you would spend, unless you escaped, you would spend the rest of the war in a POW camp. But what were these guys doing in Buchenwald? How many survived? So that started, excuse me, a journey for me of doing this research, of reaching out to the, it really took almost 6 years, and of the research, of contacting the Moser family, of contacting other people, descendants of those who have been in the concentration camp, and gathering. So there's really ended up being, Lightning Down is really two stories in one. One is the largest story of the pilots that were illegally kept in Buchenwald. And then there's the very personal story of Joe Moser, who was one of those pilots, and what his day-to-day experiences were just trying to survive.
You describe him more than once as that quiet farm boy who dreamed of flying. And it seems like he is one of those people that the closer we examine him and his life and who he was, the more we like and admire him. Tell us just a little bit more about him on this sort of basic personal level.
Well, Joe was the son of a farmer. His parents were farm people in Northwest Washington State. And he expected when he was growing up in the 1930s that he would be a farmer like his father, and that would be what the rest of his life was. His father died when he was still a teenager, so he had to sort of assume the role of being the chief worker there until his siblings got old enough to help him. But he was always fascinated with flying. When he would be out in the field, sometimes he would see these planes flying overhead, and you know, that was a great a fantasy for him, to not be a farmer, to be a pilot. And lo and behold, when Pearl Harbor happened and he enlisted in the Army, and he ended up being accepted into the Army Air Corps pilot training program, and he did very well, and then his squadron got sent overseas. They were based first in England and then after D-Day in France. And Joe was kind of a quiet, unassuming guy, but he was very acutely aware of his surroundings, and he was, you know, very acutely aware of how dangerous his missions were. And it was on his 44th mission in August 1944, and he would have rotated back to the States after his 50th mission, that he was shot down over France. And there was an attempt by local French farmers to try and hide him from the Germans, but it was unsuccessful. They captured him, took him to a prison where he was severely interrogated. And then he was put on a train with a couple of thousand other people, because at that point the Allies were closing in on Paris, and the Germans were trying to get prisoners out of Paris and send them farther to the east into camps. And so these people were on this train, including Joe, and it was a terrible, horrendous journey. I mean, 5 days and nights in the heat of August, no food or water. I mean, it was basically a bucket of water for the entire cattle car of people. And when the train finally stopped and the doors were flung open, they were at Buchenwald. Hmm. Now, I should point out that Joe is like, what the heck is Buchenwald? You know, a lot of Americans during the war did not really know of, certainly did not know really details of the Nazi concentration camps. A lot of that came out after the war. So they were very puzzled. What are we doing at this camp with these emaciated people? We're supposed to be a POW camp. And that's when it started to settle into them that something's gone terribly wrong here. And what happened was the Germans at that time in 1944, the war was turning against them. They were very desperate. And they started to take pilots if they were in any way aided by French citizens, resistance, or even just French farmers. They were being considered terrorists, Terrorfliegers, they were called. And their punishment was to be sent to a concentration camp, preferably to die as soon as possible. And that's the situation Joe and 170 other pilots found themselves in.
In other words, because Allied pilots were seen as, in a sense, bombing indiscriminately. They were not viewed by the Nazis as standard combatants, but rather as terrorists. And because of that, they did not, as far as the Nazis were concerned, fall under the auspices of, for instance, the Geneva Convention.
Geneva Convention,
and,
yes.
And so the Nazis believed they were free to do with these pilots whatever they so chose.
Yes and no. They were free to do this. I mean, there was nobody available who could stop them making this designation and sending these pilots to the Buchenwald. But they were, it was illegal. It was against the Geneva Convention. And so they had to be quiet about it, because one of the obvious concerns they had is that, well, if let's say England or America finds out that we're treating their pilots this way, they could treat our pilots and other captives in a terrible way, too. So they sent in the Buchenwald. The idea was, okay, that's their punishment. They're terrorists. Their bombs probably hit some cities, whatever. But we can't let the general world know that we're doing this. And so that's why the idea was to have these pilots die as soon as possible. And the idea was the conditions in Buchenwald, which was the largest of the Nazi concentration camps, were so terrible, were so horrible, that, you know, people were dying by the dozens, if not hundreds, per day. These pilots were not going to last very long. Mm. But they did. They banded together. They had a very inspiring leader, a New Zealand colonel, who was the senior officer. And he basically, if some people remember the movie Bridge on the River Kwai, the Alec Guinness character without the madness. Mm. And he instructed the pilots. He said, the only way we're going to survive is to support each other. We have to maintain discipline. We march together. We eat together. We do everything together. And we'll stick it to these Nazi guards who hate us, seeing us do this together and surviving day after day. And so they did survive. Not all of them, I should point out, not all of them survived, but the majority of them survived. And this was very disturbing to the Nazi government, because, you know, the longer that they survived, the greater the chance that what has been done to them would leak out, would be found out. So finally, when the orders came from Hitler personally, from Berlin, to the Buchenwald commandant, execute them. You know, we can't take any more chances. Execute them and stick them in the ovens and burn them, and there'll be no record. They never existed, as far as most people would be concerned, these pilots. They just would be missing in action and never found. And that's what happened to these pilots. They Colonel Lamassin, their leader, found out through the underground way that they had in concentration camps of feeding information to each other that he and his men were to be executed in a week's time. Hmm.
As you describe the plight of these pilots, one of the things that we learn about is how some of them came to be captured because of the deceitful conduct of certain people on the ground, Nazi collaborators that would trick pilots into trusting them and then turn them over. You tell us the story of one such Nazi collaborator, Jacques de Sibrie, who came to be known as Captain Jacques, an especially despicable example of this. Tell our listeners about him.
Yeah, one of the things that I particularly enjoyed as a writer and doing Lightning Down is there's all these intersecting stories that were kind of surprising. And one of them is what you just mentioned, Captain Jacques. He would pose as a allied sympathizer, allied helper, and his job would be to help facilitate captured pilots, well, downed pilots who were, let's say, found by the French resistance or found by French citizens and hidden away. He would be the one according to what he told people, he had this network, and you would go into his network and eventually make your way back to England or back to liberated France at that time, because the Allies had made some inroads there. And so the pilots were like, great, you know, let's do whatever this guy says. Well, what they found out only too late was, as you say, he was a Nazi collaborator. He was really a despicable person. And so he would eventually bring these pilots to the nearest Gestapo headquarters and turn them over. And obviously he was getting paid for this. He was getting all kinds of favors from the Nazis. And it's remarkable when these pilots were in Buchenwald and they're having a chance to compare capture stories. Well, how did you get captured? How did you get captured? And this guy's name kept coming up over and over and over again. And it's one of those terrible stories about World War II that people would betray other people like that. But unfortunately, it's something that happened, and it happened to quite a few of these pilots, including Joe Moser.
One of the stories on sort of the other end of it is the story of a distinguished German pilot by the name of Johannes Trautloft, who actually intervenes at one point on behalf of these Allied pilots. And really, it is because of that intervention that they are spared execution that otherwise might almost certainly have occurred. Explain to our listeners who he was and the nature of this intervention and why he would do that, the sort of code by which he was conducting himself at that moment.
Yeah, Johannes Trautloff was a German ace. You know, he was a fighter pilot. He had a very distinguished career. And as the war, although I point out in the book, he was not somebody who was, I think, even a member of the Nazi Party. He was not a supporter necessarily of the Nazis, but he was very patriotic as far as Germany was concerned. He was fighting for his country. And as you go deeper into the war, he rose through the ranks of the Luftwaffe until he was in sort of like the upper echelon there. And his you mentioned about this, there's a wonderful book by Adam Makos called A Higher Call, which was a bestseller a few years ago, and it was about the story of a German pilot and an American pilot. And there was a kind of a code of honor among pilots, even if you were enemies of each other. And that sort of happened here in the case of Lightning Down, where the Allied pilots were scheduled to be executed. The day was getting closer. They really were out of options. And yet they managed to get a message to Trautloff. And he was very dubious. What do you mean there are pilots, there are Allied pilots in the concentration camp scheduled to die? That's not the way things are done. So he arranged to do an inspection of under another, you know, guy's excuse. So he and his adjutant were doing an inspection of Buchenwald, and the commandant and his people were sort of steering him around. They didn't want him to find the pilots, but just as he's about to leave, one of the pilots calls out and says, we're here. And his conversation begins, and Trautloff is absolutely appalled that by this point, the pilots are, you know, Joe Moser, for example, is down to 105 pounds. They're in filthy rags. They're you know, their faces are sunken. There are barely bones and skin left to them. And when he sees this in the condition they're in, he's absolutely appalled. And he goes right to the Nazi hierarchy, the head of the Luftwaffe, and says, "We have to do something about this. We can't let it's a stain on our honor to treat fellow pilots this way." And sure enough, an order comes that says, "Okay, you can't execute them. You have to transfer them to a POW camp." And so people who are reading Lightning Down are going to say, "Oh, okay, that's the end of the story." But that was just one part of the journey of Joe Moser and those pilots. It turns out that they face other challenges that were even, one in particular, even more dangerous than their situation in Buchenwald.
Right. And one of the things that is truly shocking is that when they are eventually transferred to what amounts to a more proper POW camp, Stalag Luft 3, the inmates who are already there see these emaciated pilots and are told by them that they've been in Buchenwald, and they don't believe it. They think it can't possibly be true, or they are exaggerating. I mean, they are so skeptical of the story that they're being told. And how horrible for these pilots who have been through such a nightmare to not be believed. And not to jump too far ahead, but, I mean, when they ultimately return to America, they face the same kind of skepticism.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, that's exactly what happened when they got to the POW camp. They were not believed. And there's various adventures that take place in the book that I don't want to give too much away. But when Joe Moser finally gets back to the United States and he is asked, I think only about a week or two after he returns, by his local, it's either American Legion or VFW, could you tell us your experiences? And so they have a good crowd there, and he gets up and he talks about being a pilot and his missions. He was on 44 missions. He got shot down, blah, blah, blah. And he barely survived Buchenwald with these other pilots, and he concludes his talk. And as everybody's leaving, he's walking behind some people who say, I don't believe a word that guy said. He must be making this up to make himself seem like a hero. So Joe is very stung by that. And one of the reasons why this particular story remained for decades, well, basically until, you know, recently with Lightning Down, an untold story, is that these pilots who were given that kind of reaction, like Joe Moser was, said, you know what, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to say anything about it. If people are not going to believe me, I better just keep it to myself because I don't want to be people to view me as a liar or I'm embellishing things to be like a fake hero here. And it was literally decades before Joe even told his wife about what his experiences were.
Hmm. I want to return to a point that you made earlier, which was that one of the priorities of this gentleman from New Zealand, who was in a sense the head of these imprisoned pilots, was the kind of discipline that he wanted to, in a sense, impose or demand of these pilots, because he thought this is so crucial to our survival. And not only in when they are in camp, but even when they are on a couple of these terribly difficult, brutal marches, miles on end through terrible weather, even the way they march, Lamison comes up with means to maintain discipline and to make the trek a little more manageable. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, he has. In his particular column, where the pilots are, those who had survived Buchenwald, the ones who are in the front that go for like 5, 10, 15 minutes tramping down the snow in front of them, and then they move to the back of the column, and the next line tramps the snow so that there were always, you know, some relief. If you had kept the same people at the front of the line, the front of the column, who were constantly the ones, you know, stepping into the untouched snow, there would just be total exhaustion would take over and the whole column would come to a stop. Lamison believed, and he was proved to be true, that discipline was the best way to fight off despair. And despair was their enemy because of his pilots, and he considered them his pilots because he was there, became their commanding officer. He believed that if his pilots gave in to despair, that would be, the next step would be death. You know, they would have no hope of ever surviving, of ever seeing their families again, going back to their home countries. So that discipline was very, very important. And there's no doubt that many of these pilots who survived because of this heroic and inspirational New Zealand colonel who was, and not only did he inspire them by his words, but also by his deeds and his defiance of the Nazis. I mean, there's several examples in the book of where he's telling the SS guards, no, we're officers, we're not going to work, and no, we're not going to do this, and no, we're not going to do that. And he's beaten, and he even has, you know, these snarling animals. He's threatened with they're going to tear your throat out. And he stands up to them. And at any moment, any one of these German guards could have just pressed the trigger and killed him. So he really is a heroic character who, thankfully, I get a chance in Lightning Down to put a spotlight on.
I'm so glad. In our last minute or so, how is it that you were able to uncover so much information about this chapter in World War II that has been shrouded in such thick obscurity for so many years?
Well, I mean, part of it is just doing a lot of digging. I mean, I first started working on this book almost 6 years ago, so it wasn't something that could be information gathered together and just tossed off. So it was a lot of old-fashioned digging. But I was very lucky, too, because in his 80s, Joe Moser decided he wanted to tell his story. He wanted his family to know what he had experienced. He wanted anybody else who was interested in his neighborhood. He wasn't going to do a book that a lot of people would see, but he and a friend collaborated on basically a first-person memoir that was sort of privately published for friends and family. And when I first found out about this story and I contacted the Moser family, they very generously gave me a copy of it. And so I was able to use in the book not only Joe's experiences, but in some cases his own words, what he saw, what he felt, what he thought, what he did. And that was an enormous advantage to me.
The book is amazing, and again, it's titled Lightning Down, a World War II Story of Survival, published by St. Martin's Press, the author Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, you've done it again. Thank you for giving the world such a fascinating and inspiring book, and thank you for being part of the morning show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here.
You're listening to the morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm very happy, first of all, to be reconnecting with Rita Hagen, Executive Director of Hospice Alliance. And we have spoken to her a number of times over the last couple of years, including a really memorable conversation about how Hospice Alliance was carrying on with their important work, even within the restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. Rita Hagen is back on the program to talk about a special event and a bereavement event that is coming up on Thursday, that's the 11th of November, and also about a related event coming up Wednesday at 5, both events at Kemper Center in Founders Hall. The event Wednesday features a visit by an author named Sherry Bartsch, the author of a book called Heaven's Bell that ties in very nicely to the bereavement event on Thursday called Ring and Remember. And we have both Rita Hagen and Sherry Bartsch with us for the next few minutes to talk about what's going to be coming up over the next couple of days. Rita Hagen, Sherry Bartsch, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad we can have this conversation. Rita Hagen, let's begin with this notion of a bereavement event. And I understand Hospice Alliance has a couple of them over the course of the year. What do you mean by a bereavement event?
Well, what we invite those of family members and loved ones of the patients that we have lost in the previous year. But, you know, as a nonprofit and part of our community outreach, we also invite members of the community who have lost others, really at any time, but specifically in the last year. What we know about grieving is that those types of events are very, very important to people, to know that their loved one isn't going to be forgotten, to remember them, to have those opportunities, you know, to talk about them and just have some time for that. So it's an important part of what we do, and we're really happy to have it.
So what exactly happens at this event on Thursday, again, titled Ring and Remember, which I think very much ties in to the ringing of a bell?
Yes, yes. Our Ring and Remember event started probably around 2013. I had started in the fall of 12, and I believe that following year we started it based on a poem we had seen about when you ring a bell. And again, as I said earlier, is that people have the fear that, you know, people aren't going to remember their loved ones. And they always say that as long as you continue to say their name, their memories will live on. And so we have some readings that are done. We have some music, and we give a bell to everyone who participates and a copy of our poem. And that's really the night.
Very good. So again, this is Thursday at Kemper Center in Founders Hall. And although the event in some ways is especially conceived for people who have lost a loved one over the past year, including, I'm sure, you think especially of clients of Hospice Alliance who have lost somebody, this is a way to
reach out to them, but you want anybody in the community who's experienced this kind of loss anytime, and mm-hmm. whether or not they have any connection to Kenosha Hospice Alliance at all, mm-hmm. they are welcome to be part of this, correct?
Yes.
So explain this other event, which is coming up Wednesday at 5, also at Kemper's Founders Hall, and this very special author that you are excited to bring to town.
Well, we usually have a Ring and Remember here at Hospice Alliance, but as a part of our celebrating of 40 years, we wanted to do something at Kemper, which is where our brick walk has been always and still is. And I had received a copy of the book, Heaven's Bells, and I read it very quickly because it was an amazing book. I really couldn't put it down, told this incredible story. And I sent an email to Sherry, who was so kind and said, sure, I will come and do an event for you. It was just wonderful because her story is just the perfect setup for what we've been telling our families forever, but it gives it from the side of those who have left us. And so I don't want to say too much. I'll let Sherry talk about it, but we are grateful, and it's a wonderful story, and we're very excited for it.
Thank you. I thought you just did an excellent job. I don't know if I can follow that or not, but I was so pleased to receive her call, and she was so kind in her overview of the story.
We should probably explain to our listeners that you make your living another way, not as someone who writes books for a living. Explain what kind of the course of your normal life is.
The course of my normal life is I actually have three organizations that I am the CEO of in executive search and leadership. And so in the midst of COVID, I call it my COVID project. I always had this story, and very similar to what Rita described, of bells ringing in heaven. And I found myself really just needing to get that story out there and helping, especially children, but families of all ages that were coping with such a devastating loss with COVID. And so, so I'm a first-time author. I actually started another book and then ended up finishing this book first because I just thought the need was so high in what our communities were losing and the suffering that was happening.
Right. And I remember reading or hearing you say that part of this was, of course, there's been a lot of death from COVID, and that unlike normal circumstances in which we can typically experience those losses with a sense of community and in a lot of different ways, that because of COVID, especially at the onset of the epidemic, a lot of those traditional kind of gatherings, funerals, and memorial services were not possible. And so you had a sense that a lot of people were going through these kind of losses and not being able to process them the way they normally would. Is that right?
Correct. Correct. And what the book does is it's storytelling. And I think it's really about the power of storytelling. And Heaven's Bell is just one story. It's almost an icebreaker to get the memories flowing, but everybody has their own Heaven's Bell story. And if the story that I wrote can prompt everyone else to start sharing their memories and talking about their loved ones, that's where the healing starts to take place. And in the book, there's journal pages, there's drawing pages at the very back. And what I saw people do is read the book, start writing memories in the book, and even young kids would put stickers in there or crayons, you know, they would draw pictures and then send it around to their whole family because no one could get together. And then they would send that to the family member or the family that lost the member of their family. And the stories that I got in response were just kept me moving forward and trying to get the story of Heaven's Bell out. So when Rita called, I was touched and thrilled and wanted to help in any way that I could.
So at the center of this story, which is a work of fiction, correct? At the center of this is two extremely close friends, and they are young people. I think they're teenagers, and then they face the really frightening prospect of one of them losing the other. Explain a little more about the central premise. Explain a little bit about these two central characters and their relationship.
Well, what I can promise you is there is loss, but it's not a sad book. I truly believe it's a hopeful book, and in the end, you'll find peace. It's basically two 11-year-old best friends. One goes to heaven, and we get to see and learn about Cody in heaven. And it's whimsical. It's described as outer space. It's the feedback that I've received is it creates a very visual way to understand maybe what might be happening in heaven. And at the same time, Ashley is on Earth, and we get to watch her journey as well, how she's remembering him, and she lives a long life. And then in the end of the book, you get to see how they're reunited in heaven and how they haven't missed a beat. That really what you've got in heaven is this peace and this loved one that's actually meeting some of their loved ones, and the opportunity to see generations that are up there, and they're celebrating by ringing bells, and they're waiting for you, but they don't want you to be in a hurry. Mm. They want you to live your life peacefully and know that they're okay.
I know that one thing that was really important for you was to frame this story, and in particular, this notion of heaven that's talked about in the book, in a way that is not tied to any particular religious system, either yours or anybody else's. You've tried to paint this picture in a way that just about anybody of just about any religious faith or no religious faith at all,
correct,
can relate to this and sort of embrace the picture as their own.
Correct. It's yes, there is a heaven, but it's light. And it's almost seen through the eyes of an 11-year-old, right? Which describing it as outer space. I don't want to give away too much, but even the way heaven is described, it really is described through the eyes of an 11-year-old.
Interesting. I know that you are a mother of, I think, three boys.
Correct.
What kind of impact did that have on you as you sort of shaped this book and wrote it? I have no idea how old your three sons are, or if any of them are still children at all, but I suspect something of your experience of mothering them and knowing them probably played a role in why you wanted to write this particular story.
Yes, I did. They're older now, but two of my three boys were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in the same year when they were in grade school, and with no family history at all. You know, it's really sitting down and having tough and serious conversations with children. And I think sometimes we shield children from those really hard conversations because we as adults and parents are coping. We have a tendency to be protective, maybe not have the difficult conversation. So when I thought about, and actually diabetes, one of my children said, well, die is in the word diabetes. So I'm probably going to die. And what does that mean? So it really, at the heart of Heaven's Bell, it's about having difficult conversations. And in this particular book, it's about death and what happens. But we have to be able to create space to explore how our kids are feeling, and not necessarily our as a parent or as a caregiver, our perspective of how they should be feeling, but instead creating a forum for how they might be able to express how they're feeling. And that's really where Heaven's Bell came from. Let me think. It's just safer. And that's how they influenced my storytelling.
Very good. Rita Hagen, I'm sure as you're hearing this, it brings to mind for you and your staff at Hospice Alliance some of the special challenges that are involved when you are working with families that include children who have to process loss in a way that probably is especially difficult, and I should think probably especially challenging for you and your staff.
Right, and as many of the things that Sherry said, I mean, I think that was another reason that I just loved this book, because, you know, I've often talked about those difficult conversations, whether it's knowing you're going to die and being able to talk to your family about them, or that someone is dying and we've had people say, well, don't let them know, we don't want to talk about it. And so this book helps, I think, families to be able to have those tough conversations that are so very important, because there's also families who, once someone dies, because of all the emotions involved, they don't ever talk about them again. And especially then children, they never get that chance to do, like Sherry said, to be able to express themselves. And that's so important. So, you know, we are starting the Connections Planting Seeds of Hope, which is a children and family bereavement program. So we're excited to use this book with our families. I think it will make a huge difference, and we're thrilled about that. And the fact that it mentions heaven, and like Sherry said, it doesn't, you know, in hospice, that's very important because we care for all people of all faiths or of no faith. But it does tell this story in such an amazing way that it's not religious. It's just a reference to this place called heaven. But it's just very well done. I think people will love it.
So explain, Rita, what exactly is going to happen at Wednesday's event at Kemper's Founders Hall.
Well, we'll have copies of the books available, but really Sherry's going to be there to talk, similar to what she's saying now, about how the story came. Look, maybe even some, read some parts of the book. Sherry can probably certainly explain that better than I, but it's just really very relaxed and maybe even gives people an opportunity to talk and share a little bit as well.
Very good. Sherry Bartsch, anything you want to add?
I'm grateful for the opportunity, and I hope we see you there.
So Sherry Bartsch, author of Heaven's Bell, comes to Kenosha and to Kemper Center and Founders Hall for an event Wednesday at 5 p.m. The public is very warmly invited to attend. And then Thursday, also at 5, also at Kemper Center's Founders Hall, the Ring and Remember event will be taking place, in which people who either have lost someone over the past year, or even if that loss extends longer ago than that, and whether or not that loss involved Kenosha Hospice Alliance, that does not matter. But anybody is welcome to come to this special bereavement event. Rita Hagen, Executive Director of Hospice Alliance, and Sherry Bartsch, author of Heaven's Bell. I'm so glad we were able to have this conversation. Thank you so much, and best wishes to both of you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, several different interviews, including one with Tamara Winfrey Harris, talking about the new edition of her book, The Sisters Are All Right, Changing the Broken Narrative of Black Women in America. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. We have a couple of minutes left in the hour, and so we're going to remember composer Dmitri Shostakovich, who passed away on this date back in 1975. Here is one of his most brilliant and wonderful works, his festive overture, played by the Cincinnati Pops under Eric Kunzel.